I was guilty until proven innocent, and I knew that this brutality would be justified. After I'd sat in the police car for a period of time, the officers, at my insistence, Googled my name and saw that I was in fact a famous football player, clearly not famous enough, and they let me go. What if I weren't famous? How would my night have ended? It showed me that because equality doesn't live in this country, no matter how much money you make, what job title you have, or how much you give, when you are seen as a nigger, you will be treated that way. Afterward, I went public with what happened. I waited a week because I needed to psychologically recover. Also, Hurricane Harvey was wrecking Houston, and I didn't want to take focus away from raising funds to help my hometown. When I did go public, the Las Vegas Police Union accused me of lying. They called on the NFL to investigate my false statements and said that my politics around the anthem action somehow justified this move. They wrote to Roger Goodell, "While the NFL may condone Bennett's disrespect for the American flag and everything it symbolizes, we hope the league will not ignore Bennett's false accusations against our police officers." The craziest part is that video had already come out that showed exactly what I said had happened. Me on my stomach, hands cuffed, a weapon placed against the back of my head. No charges were brought against me. And yet, to the police and people who hated that I was speaking out, I'm a liar. Why? Because the officers were Latino, and therefore their actions couldn't have been racial profiling. I don't believe anyone is so stupid as to think being a black or brown police officer magically prevents you from racial profiling. They also said I was a liar because the LVPD released video of my shaking the officer's hand after being released. Trust me, if you ever feel like your life is in someone else's hands and they let you go, a flood of relief would flow from you as well. I think their real reason for calling me a liar is that their whole worldview is built around the idea that racism in policing doesn't exist. They would rather live in the comfort of that fiction than be forced to confront the uncomfortable truth, that racial profiling is a reality. For some, calling me a liar is also a cover for what they truly think, that I deserved to be brutalized, and that black lives simply do not matter. My belief in this movement is why it was important to me to talk openly in dueling press conferences with my brother Richard Sherman about why I support Black Lives Matter. There are so many dishonest ways that this movement is attacked, and Richard gave credence to the most commonly repeated slander. It's an attack tactic used by some of the same people who have treated Richard like he's the devil with braids, the idea that we don't care about what is called black-on-black crime. Our back and forth started when Richard was falsely accused of liking a post online that mentioned killing police. It was all a lie, and Richard held a press conference where he spoke about his support for law enforcement. He then said, "I dealt with a best friend getting killed. It was 2 35-year-old black men. Wasn't no police officer involved, wasn't anybody else involved, and I didn't hear anybody shouting Black Lives Matter then. As long as we have black-on-black crime and one black man killing another, if black lives matter, then it should matter all the time." I respected that he was speaking from the heart and felt for his loss, but I also disagreed with his position. And at my own press conference, I said, "When people talk about the Black Lives Matter thing, I think he's misinterpreting it. Yes, black people kill black people. White people also kill white people. People kill people every day. This is about social injustice, the people that are supposed to protect them." I didn't call a press conference because of Richard. We could have talked privately like we do all the time. He's sharp as hell, and I know he'd listen. I went public because I wanted not just Richard, but everyone to realize that looking only at street crime, tragic as it is, ignores the larger problem. The problem is a system that inflicts inadequate schools, lack of clean water, and lack of jobs on the black community, and police violence is a part of compelling us to accept second-class citizenship. For us, it's a situation of, you were put here to protect us, but who protects us from you? In too many cities, Police should be a resource for comfort and safety, not a symbol of fear. The point is not that Black lives matter more, but that they need to matter as much as everyone else's. Unfortunately, it doesn't look like this society, from the White House down, agrees. I support the Black Lives Matter movement, and I feel it is important for us to stand up and say that until there is true equality, we will not accept the way you are treating us. Richard and I disagreed, but we also talked about it behind the scenes. I said to him that it's cool for us to see things differently, but while I respect him and his opinion, I felt I needed to give my perspective so that a different side was presented to the world. I told him I thought there was an institutional problem we needed to confront. Yes, I do believe that black people killing black people is one hell of a problem. But when people are being killed by those who are supposed to protect them, we need to raise our voices. I also wanted him to understand that the Black Lives Matter movement doesn't involve just black people. There are white, Latino, Latina, Muslim, Jewish, and Asian supporters in this movement. All types of people who are looking reality in the face and saying that black lives must matter also. I asked Richard to think about everything he has accomplished in this life, and my dude has done a lot. He gives back to the community in ways that get no publicity, but directly impact people's lives. He does amazing things. But I asked him to think about why his path has been so hard, and whether it really had to be that way. Behind the scenes, it wasn't just a conversation between Richard and me. It blew up throughout the locker room. There were about 10 of us talking. But everyone knew it was going down and pricked up their ears. The discussion was heated but respectful. Everybody had differing opinions, but at the core was an acknowledgement that, as black professional athletes, we are all outliers. We have been able to overcome the institutional obstacles that most people from our backgrounds would never ever have had the chance to overcome, simply because we played sports freakishly well. We got pushed through the system in a lot of ways that most people wouldn't, because we are in the athletic top 0.01%. That is a blessing, but it also comes with a responsibility not to forget those left behind. We all grew up with so many others who were smarter, more creative, or more analytical than we were, but because their abilities and intelligences were not reflected in sports, they didn't have our opportunities. We have to acknowledge that. We can't be the kind of people who look down on where we came from with the attitude, "We made it, you should have made it too." That sends the message that if you can't sing great, rap great, or dance great, if you can't dunk the basketball or run 40 yards in under 4.4 seconds, then your avenues for advancement don't exist. That is sick. I said to Richard, "Bro, look at the system. We can take you to different neighborhoods, whether it's in Ferguson or Houston or Baltimore, and all you have to do is look at schools to know that black lives do not matter." I told him about my mom, who was a school teacher for more than 20 years. She came home from work every day pulling her hair out by the roots, because she knew there was a system keeping people down, and trying to work within that system can feel like shoveling sand in the damn ocean, or beating your head against a wall in the hopes that it might crack the facade, knowing you will just end up with a concussion. We went back and forth. I said that we have to look beyond the issue of black-on-black crime, because segregation dramatically distorts those statistics. If I lived in an all-white neighborhood, the murderers would be white murderers. If I lived in an all-Mexican neighborhood, there would be Mexican-on-Mexican murder. These killings also track entirely by income. Michelle Alexander, the professor who wrote The New Jim Crow, published a study on the topic. Middle-class black kids are not killing each other because they're thinking about their college applications. It was a good discussion, in many ways a great discussion, because we had it publicly and then continued it in the locker room. We utilized our platform and also were able to expand the consciousness of our brotherhood. Both of those things matter. As for Richard, he was a leading voice in the 2017 offseason, speaking out for Kaepernick and speaking out for me after my experience in Las Vegas with the reality of racial profiling that we face. My evolution towards supporting the Black Lives Matter movement and sitting for the anthem can also come down to three names: Trayvon, Ferguson, and Kaepernick. When Trayvon Martin was killed in Sanford, Florida, I was living with my family about 100 miles away because I was playing in Tampa Bay. I remember hearing the news and being instantly stunned, knowing this would go national. He was 17 years old, hunted down and killed for going out at halftime of the NBA All-Star game to buy some iced tea and Skittles. And they wouldn't even arrest his killer. I just sat back and thought, damn, this young boy didn't even get to experience the world. He didn't really get to live or have his own family or know what it feels like to kiss your wife and tell her you'll be back for dinner or see his kids graduate from college. He'll never be able to show his mom her new grandkids. That experience was taken. It hit me and many across the country so hard. The white people who weren't on right-wing talk radio trying to somehow make excuses for his death, as if wearing a hoodie should be a death sentence, were shocked, saying, "This still happens?" But black people were saying, "Again? Another kid?" If any other race were losing kids the way black families are losing kids, it would be a national emergency. If a white kid had been shot by some stalker pretending to be a police officer, and the shooter at first wasn't even arrested and then was acquitted, everybody would have lost their minds. But too many people didn't give a damn. They didn't care that the killer, and I don't say his name, was a vigilante, not a police officer. They didn't care that he hunted down this young man even after a 911 dispatcher told him to stop. After Trayvon was brought to the morgue, they drug tested him, but not his killer. People didn't care. Then came the 2014 killing of Michael Brown by Officer Darren Wilson in Ferguson, Missouri, which happened when I was back in Seattle. This was the first social media death where the mourning was made all the more raw because Michael Brown's body was left lying in the street for hours, and we all saw it live-streamed. The disrespecting of his corpse and the people crying, horrified that he was being treated worse than garbage. I remember seeing this and just thinking, do I even want a black son? That was going through my head. It breaks my heart to share that. Then people fought back, made history, and launched this movement. When the Ferguson Rebellion popped off, our locker room came together to talk about it as a team. We had to talk about it because footage of the fires and tear gas and police in a tank was on TV in the training room. It was everywhere. There were 10 small discussions happening around different lockers, and as a leader, you have to know when to bring people together. Several of us were telling others on our team that Ferguson was familiar territory, that this was not new. There may be new technology, new phones, new ways to zap these images around the world in a heartbeat, and new military hardware being used by police, but it's the same murders. It's the same kids being targeted. It's little different than in the 1960s. Hell, the classrooms in Ferguson probably still used textbooks from the 1960s. Some of us were shocked that this had happened in America. Others of us were jaded. But what we all had in common was trying to grasp why this was still happening in the 21st century, and how the country could see us as heroes on the field and as disposable off the field. We played St. Louis just 2 weeks later, and the players on the Rams came out on the field with the hands up, don't shoot pose. When I saw them with their hands up, I was all for it. Those who did it were all offensive players like wide receiver Kenny Britt and running back Trey Mason. I was so proud of them it almost made me sad that I was going to have to knock the snot out of them. I supported the Rams' action especially because Ferguson is a forgotten part of their city. And as they were bringing Michael Brown's death to Monday Night Football, a military crackdown was happening just a few miles away. It takes that kind of solidarity to make any kind of change. When we played the 49ers soon after, I got a sack and struck the same pose. Hands up, don't shoot. A lot of white people still don't understand what that slogan even means. They counter with the disputed argument that Michael Brown's hands weren't up, Therefore, the very gesture spreads a lie about how he was killed. That's not the issue. Hands up, don't shoot speaks to the fact that you can do everything right when interacting with the police. You can hold your hands up high, remember every detail of the talk with your parents, and still be shot. Ask Terrence Crutcher of Tulsa, Oklahoma. His murder was all caught on video. He walked toward Officer Betty Shelby, his hands held up high, and he was still struck down. Even though this was videotaped, she wasn't only acquitted. She got her job back along with back pay, and the killing will be wiped from her employment record. She literally is getting away with murder. As I've said, people call the NFL the No Fun League. They will fine you if you've got the wrong color shoelaces on. Yet after Ferguson, when players were raising their hands and writing things like, "My children's lives matter" on their uniforms, the league office didn't come down with fines. I tried to do something a little more fresh and wear cleats with Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X airbrushed on, but they said I couldn't. Too bad. I liked those cleats. The bigger point is that I think Roger Goodell is still a human being, so maybe he felt something. Even though some might think he's an owner-controlled hand puppet, he had a human response to that moment back in 2014. Not to say that NFL headquarters supports the movement, but at that particular moment, they could tell it wasn't the best time to crush players who spoke out or altered their uniforms a fraction. Also, black men make up 70% of the players. I think they knew that if they tried to crack down on us, they'd open up one hell of a confrontation. Maybe the pain of Trayvon Martin's family, the pain of Mike Brown's family, and the pain of the entire town of Ferguson was enough for them to say, let the players express what they are feeling. Of course, the limits of what they're willing to accept were exposed when Colin Kaepernick took the Black Lives Matter protest to the national anthem. Colin opened up so many eyes and took so much abuse for stepping out first. It hurt him that he is a quarterback, the face of a franchise. He was also at the end of his contract. The courage to do what he did, given his situation, is greatly undervalued. As I said earlier, I'm sitting during the anthem in part because I'm not going to let the memory of Colin's action die, and I know I'm not alone. NFL executives have talked anonymously to the media about Kaepernick, and it's a sin, the things they've said, without giving their names. They've compared him to Ray Carruth, a Carolina Panthers wide receiver who had his pregnant girlfriend killed. He had her killed, and that's how they've categorized Colin. They are scared of black men who overcome the fear to stand up. So many people can't handle that. That's why the lives of powerful black men and women have been destroyed or simply snatched. Who would want to step up given those risks? But still we do. When I read a biography of Fred Hampton, it was clear that he was aware of the risks to his personal safety, but he also knew he had the power to change lives. He knew he could make black lives matter. Then there is my hero, Muhammad Ali. The public only embraced him after he lost the power of speech late in his life. But Muhammad Ali, to me, was always a hero because he talked all kinds of smack about politics, Nixon, and black life, and he backed it up. He was willing to say what needed to be said, no matter the persecution. He lived by a code that is easy to say but so hard to follow. Speak the truth, even if it hurts. And if you don't agree with some shit, don't mumble around it. Ali said it and made it plain. I don't agree with killing the Viet Cong. They didn't do anything to me. They never called me nigger. People here call me nigger every day. You won't let me in the restaurant? My wife can't even go to the same store. And you're telling me I should go to the white man's war? My commitment to Black Lives Matter is to make sure that people like Fred Hampton and Muhammad Ali did not die in vain. We will build on what they brought to our lives. It's called standing on the shoulders of giants. My open commitment to the Black Lives Matter movement beyond on-field gestures, social media posts, and locker room debates started in Seattle at an event in 2016 called Black Lives Matter in Schools. Teachers planning to teach black history at a local elementary school had received death threats. When that kind of thing happens in your community, you have to step up. For the day of the event, the Seattle Teachers Union asked all the educators in the city to wear Black Lives Matter shirts in protest, and it was a tremendous success. More than 3,000 out of the 5,000 total Seattle teachers of all races and ethnicities wore the shirts to school. Then they held a rally, and I was a part of it. Being there made me feel like people must have felt in the 1960s when they first heard about black power, except this was more multiracial and united across color, which made it all the more moving to me. I felt a resurgence of love for being black and love for looking the way I do. Love of my skin, love of my shade, love for the way my hair grows out. I already loved my beard, so I was good there. I went up on stage, and teachers and students started asking me questions, thanking me for being there, but also challenging me to think about what I was doing and whether I could do more. It was a life-changing moment for me, and I just laid it all out, pledging my support and explaining what some of the Seahawks players could do to support the efforts of this amazing community. I figured that no matter what I said, somebody was going to find something wrong with it. So I might as well be authentic and honest. People thought Black Lives Matter was a fad, or that it was going to die out. But I hope we realize that this goes way beyond just a hashtag. To me, this movement is not only about responding to police violence. Not at all. I see black and brown people committing suicide. I see white people dying of opioid overdoses. It seems like people don't want to live anymore. People don't want to be in a world where they feel they're not valued. They're checking out early. They're thinking, why live through this? We need to give each other hope. Imagine you are walking down the street and see someone getting beaten in a shadowy corner. You immediately ask yourself, should I help, or do I mind my own business? Do I choose silence, or do I take action? That's how I view everything. Society says that you shouldn't get involved because it's not your problem. But your conscience tells you that you should speak up because you know deep down inside that this is the right thing to do. That's the battle we have with ourselves every day. Most people lose that battle because they think, I don't want to risk looking stupid or getting hurt or wasting my time. Better to just send a tweet. But we need to do more than that. And we need to reach out beyond where it's comfortable. When black people talk about black people's problems, the problems never get solved. I want to push white people to think about their roles, to think about how these issues affect them also, to think about how when we come together we can confront common ills that exist in all communities, black, brown, and white, that have been left behind. We could come together, or we could blame each other. But we're not going to come together without trust, and I don't see trust being built until white people say, black lives need to matter as much as white ones. When a white person gets involved, other people take notice. The people whose kids aren't being killed in the streets. That's when we will see change. This is something for all of us to organize around, wherever we stand. Where I stand happens to be in the National Football League. And when white players step up and speak out, it changes the whole dynamic. It's been so gratifying to see white players begin to move in that direction. When Justin Britt, Chris Long, and Sean DeValve got involved in the anthem actions, it brought an entire white audience into the dialogue and shifted the conversation, even if only a little bit. That solidarity, as it grows, can change the world. Intersectionality also matters. You're not designed to thrive by yourself. Maya Moore. Solidarity is the idea that we can organize around a common goal, uniting across our differences in skin color or gender or sexuality to make a better world for future generations. It's why I stood with the Palestinian people. It's why I stood with the Women's Strike for Equality. And it's why I wore a Bernie Sanders hat around NFL locker rooms. But we will get to all that. Intersectionality is related, but different. It's understanding that an individual can experience multiple types of injustice, which we need to acknowledge, and that although our struggles may be different, they overlap or intersect. Intersectionality clicked for me when I thought about Charlena Lyles. She was killed because of racism, no doubt, but her life as a black woman, not just as a black person, is critical to understanding her death. Charlena had suffered sexual assault and violence, and she called the police in the first place because she was worried that an abusive former lover was coming back to hurt her. I understand what it's like to be black and feel like your life is in the hands of a police officer pointing a weapon at you. But combining that with the fear of violence because you're a woman is something I had never experienced. I realized that I needed to understand the impact of both the racism and the sexism, and not only her death, but also how the incident played out afterward, when she was painted as an unfit mother, as if that justified killing her in front of her children. This understanding of how multiple oppressions can overlap is the politics of intersectionality. Years before I knew what intersectionality was, before I even knew the word existed, I felt it when I learned how Muhammad Ali connected the struggle of black people in this country with the devastation of the Vietnamese people and his push to end the U.S. war in Vietnam. If you have never read his words before, if you only know Muhammad Ali as a poster, a t-shirt, or the dude played by Will Smith, read this speech he gave at a fair housing rally in his hometown of Louisville, Kentucky, back in 1968. Why should they ask me to put on a uniform and go 10,000 miles from home and drop bombs and bullets on brown people in Vietnam while so-called Negro people in Louisville are treated like dogs and denied simple human rights? No, I'm not going 10,000 miles from home to help murder and burn another poor nation simply to continue the domination of white slave masters of the darker people the world over. This is the day when such evils must come to an end. I have been warned that to take such a stand would cost me millions of dollars. But I have said it once, and I will say it again. The real enemy of my people is here. I will not disgrace my religion, my people, or myself by becoming a tool to enslave those who are fighting for their own justice, freedom, and equality. If I thought the war was going to bring freedom and equality to 22 million of my people, they wouldn't have to draft me. I'd join tomorrow. I have nothing to lose by standing up for my beliefs. So I'll go to jail. So what? We've been in jail for 400 years. That's intersectionality to me. Muhammad Ali wasn't Vietnamese. He had never been to Saigon. He, like most Americans at the time, probably couldn't have found Vietnam on a map. But he identified with what they were going through. Their oppression sounded like his oppression. They shared the common experience of being brutalized by those in power, though Ali noted their realities were very different. He wasn't being napalmed. Ali offered solidarity, hope, and even his own freedom in support of their struggle. The Olympic protesters, Tommy Smith and John Carlos, also taught me about intersectionality. Nobody remembers who won all the medals at the 1968 Mexico City Olympics. But every time I see that photo of their fists in the air on the medal stand, I'm reminded that it wasn't just a black project, but a human rights project. When you dig deeper into the history, you learn that they weren't just standing up for themselves. They were standing with the people of South Africa and Rhodesia, who were living under apartheid. You learn that the all-white Harvard crew team stood with them, and even created the buttons they wore on the medal stand, which read, Olympic Project for Human Rights. The Black Panther Fred Hampton also taught me about intersectionality. Everyone should know more about Fred Hampton. He was killed, executed, by the Chicago police in collusion with the FBI when he was just 21 years old, and his loss continues to be felt. Hampton was so far ahead of his time that we're still catching up. He saw working with Native Americans, poor white people, and gay people as essential to the black struggle. He created the first Rainbow Coalition. It was logical to him to find connections between different struggles, but somewhere along the way, since his death, we've lost that logic. Today we are fighting for Black Lives Matter and black liberation, but we will succeed only if we can figure out how to connect our struggle with every other effort out there for justice and equality. That's why you see me working with Native Americans, Palestinians, women, and people in Africa and Haiti. To practice intersectionality, I believe you have to remove yourself from the fear or discomfort of associating with certain groups or issues you've been taught to ignore. I know black people who don't care about immigrants, men who don't care about women, and straight people who don't care about gay people. Why are we like this? Why don't we care? Maybe we are so divided by tribe that we're taught that caring for someone outside our assigned category is the ultimate sin. Yet I would argue that it's the ultimate expression of being part of the human family. You grow and come to understand that there's so much more to this world than just your bubble. You learn that we can't organize along the same lines that keep us divided. Intersectionality has to be a part of our thinking if we are ever going to see change. We need to take heart Dr. King's words that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. Right now, being an immigrant, or even looking like you might be an immigrant from what some call shithole countries, means having a target on your back. Muslims, refugees, and Latinos in particular are living through terror. Anti-Latino hate crimes have increased by 50% in the last 5 years, with a big spike since the start of Trump's presidential campaign when he called Mexican immigrants rapists. The school-to-prison pipeline divides us as well, with Latino youth 3 times more likely to be suspended, expelled, or referred to court than white students who do the same things. You are 3 times more likely to live behind bars if you are Latino than if you are white. Then there is the issue of wealth. The average Latino household has only 8% of the wealth of the average white household, and they make 67 cents on the dollar compared to white men. A Latina has to work 22 months to earn what white workers of similar educational levels make in a year. Until we confront these realities, how can we possibly tell people that education and hard work alone, without political struggle, are enough to make the change we are so desperate to see? Intersectionality as a political method allows us to make these connections and unite. As for being Muslim, damn. The number of assaults against Muslims in the United States rose like crazy between 2015 and 2016. According to the Pew Research Center, it's worse now than it was after 9/11. That means assaults, vandalism, and broken windows. Those people who march with the tiki torches think they're tough, but they're afraid. They are afraid to face what the United States has done to other countries around the world, resulting in thousands upon thousands of people seeking to come here. They are afraid of confronting their own bigotry. They are afraid of their own irrelevance. There are people who might give me a break if I only talked about Black Lives Matter because I'm black. But when I start talking about rights for other people, I'm marked. I think we get attacked for standing up for others precisely because doing so opens an avenue for change, and change threatens the status quo and those in positions of power. And that can bring you all kinds of unwanted attention. Unwanted attention that's a little bit more serious than jumping off sides in the fourth quarter or being on TMZ. Central to this intersectional practice is collaboration. Collaboration is how a message has the potential to catch on like wildfire. You can't build the Statue of Liberty by yourself. You need legions of people who want to build it with you. You need sisters and brothers willing to carry the bricks and the cement. You need everyone to offer up their special skills. You have to ask, do we all believe in this goal? If so, then who knows how to design? Who knows how to hammer? Who knows how to spread the word? This goes back to Fred Hampton, who said that the goal of any movement is to help people believe in themselves and understand that they have the potential to remake the world. Most people don't see that in themselves. Intersectionality is why I made a decision to turn down a trip to visit Israel. I wanted to go, but not if it meant seeing only one side. It wasn't easy for me because I knew how bad the backlash would be. I knew that when I made this decision, some people were going to say, "That guy is the enemy. I don't want to cheer for him no more. I don't want to buy his jersey no more. He is dead to us." That was a given. But I also didn't know if someone might go as far as saying, "I want to kill his family. I want to do whatever is needed to fucking keep him from talking again." But my reasons for turning down this trip and doing so as publicly as possible were in step with my morals and my beliefs. I want to take the opportunity to explain, because it's a microcosm of how the intersectional approach works in my mind. 11 NFL players were slated to be part of a goodwill delegation to Israel, all expenses paid. When I was asked to do it, my first thought was, hey, free trip to Israel, first class tickets, why not? I didn't really do any background research on what the trip was, where I would be allowed to go, and who I would be able to talk to, so I can honestly say that was my fault, and I will never make that mistake again. A few weeks before we were set to leave, the Times of Israel ran an article about the trip that described it as a highly organized Israeli government-designed operation with the aim of turning me and the other NFL players into goodwill ambassadors who would return to the United States to fight perceptions of the country. I learned that the trip would pretty much isolate us from the Palestinian people. I had to ask why they intentionally did not want to expose us to the entire country. I had visited other countries all over the world, and none had ever asked me to be a goodwill ambassador. To truly be a goodwill ambassador, you need to see both sides so you can represent what is happening. It made me concerned about the entire trip, but before I decided not to go, I knew I had to educate myself on the situation over there. I had to be humble enough to realize that I knew very little about Israel and Palestine, so I went on a crash course about the history of the region. It was like cramming for a final exam. I locked myself in my room. I spoke to scholars and academics. I picked up a stack of books from every angle so I could do my own research. The life-altering point was reading a book called Freedom is a Constant Struggle, written by Angela Davis in 2015. I learned that Black Lives Matter activists had created all kinds of bonds and communications with the Palestinian people, and that there was a mural of Michael Brown on the Palestinian side of the separation wall that Israel built around Gaza. They were even communicating over Skype about how best to deal with tear gas. Instead of using water to flush your eyes, use milk. I can honestly say that, as a man, I cried when I read about this connection. In such a dark time in our country, I felt inspired. Pele asked me, "Why are you so emotional about this?" And I told her I hadn't known how bad it was, and the strength of people in impossible situations had touched my soul. That's when I knew I had to step up and not only refuse the trip, but also tell the people about why I wasn't going. I think it bothered some people that I didn't go. But I'd seen some things in my reading and research that I couldn't unsee. I'd seen in my mind's eye the kids, the women, the men, the checkpoints, the schools, the sewage in the streets, the poverty, and the wall. I felt a kinship with a struggle that in so many ways reminds me of the civil rights movement or the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa. I realized that I wouldn't be the person I aspire to be if I called out injustice here at home and just stopped at our border. It doesn't work that way. One of the most powerful moments in this journey was when I received a call from Angela Davis. Not only is she a hero of mine, but I had just read her book. This was the first time we had ever spoken, and since then we've become friends, which is trippy as hell. Angela Davis took the time to share with me her personal experiences of traveling through Palestine and seeing how the Palestinians were treated, their living conditions, the history of how their land was taken away from them by illegal settlements, and how they are all collectively punished for the violent actions of a few. I also spoke to Palestinian-American scholar and professor Noura Erekat, and ended up meeting with her students at Georgetown, including Israeli students. In talking to Angela Davis and Noura Erekat, I realized I had empathy and identification with the Palestinian people that I didn't know existed inside of me. We're dealing with police violence here, and what they are dealing with there sounds too familiar to ignore. After educating myself on the subject, I felt that the only moral thing for me to do was to stand on the right side of history, to stand on the shoulders of my ancestors, and be a bridge between oppressed people. Palestine was no different. I might not have thought too much about their situation before this, but now it just wasn't acceptable, and I wasn't going to be used in that way. The next decision was whether to quietly refuse to go and make up an excuse, or to share my thoughts with the world. I chose the latter, and wrote the following open letter. Dear World, I was scheduled to make a visit to Israel with fellow NFL players. I was excited to see this remarkable and historic part of the world with my own eyes. I was not aware until reading this article about the trip in The Times of Israel that my itinerary was being constructed by the Israeli government for the purposes of making me, in the words of a government official, an influencer and opinion former, who would then be an ambassador of goodwill. I will not be used in such a manner. When I do go to Israel, and I do plan to go, it will be to see not only Israel, but also the West Bank and Gaza, so I can see how the Palestinians who have called this land home for thousands of years live their lives. One of my heroes has always been Muhammad Ali. I know that Ali always stood strongly with the Palestinian people, visiting refugee camps, going to rallies, and always willing to be a voice for the voiceless. I want to be a voice for the voiceless, and I cannot do that by going on this kind of trip to Israel. I know that this will anger some people and inspire others, but please know that I did this not for you, but to be in accord with my own values and my own conscience. Like 1968 Olympian John Carlos always says, there is no partial commitment to justice. You are either in or you're out. Well, I'm in. Sincerely, Michael Bennett. When I posted the letter to my Instagram account, I had no idea that it would become front page news in Israel and a topic of debate throughout Europe. It was crazy. They don't even like American football in Europe, but they were talking about me. Sometimes you just throw a stone out there and hope for a ripple, and sometimes the stone makes a hell of a wave. It was a big deal. The response was political whiplash, a storm of attention about a situation where I was just learning the basics. As pro athletes, we're stuck in a world where our days start at 6 a.m. We don't get done until 6 p.m., and when we get home, we play with the kids, eat dinner, get our rest, and then do it all over again. The world around us is like a rumor, a barely noticeable buzz that needs to roar if we are going to pay it any attention. What was so cool about this experience was that the buzz did become a roar, and minds were open to both critical thinking and the effect athletes can have on the world. By the time you're listening to this book, I will be making plans to travel to Israel and Palestine on a trip not designed by the government, so I can explore everything about that part of the world, the good, the bad, and the ugly, for myself. In addition to learning about the politics and history, the best part of this experience is that now the last thing many people want to talk about with me is football. I love that, because if people only know you for what you do on the field, obviously they're only going to talk to you about sports. When people know more about what you believe in, what your morals are, you'll have better conversations. People want to hear more, and I am willing to say more. It's beautiful. People asking me about football all the time gets old, It's like being a plumber and all people want to talk to you about is toilets. If I were a plumber, I might still have my passion for toilets, but I'd also need a break when the plunger goes back in the closet. This desire to link people up and push forward for united change is also why I supported Senator Bernie Sanders for president in 2016. I wore a Bernie Sanders baseball hat both to press conferences and in the locker room. Hell, I wore that Bernie Sanders hat all around Seattle. I liked what he was talking about. So one day I snatched the hat from the head of a friend. I was like, "Man, give me that Bernie Sanders hat." He said, "You want this hat for real?" I said, "I'll wear that hat every day." I did. And in Seattle, people went crazy for it. People love Bernie in Seattle like they love coffee. But outside the Seattle zone, people were talking like this was the weirdest thing they had ever seen. A football player supporting Bernie Sanders. It didn't compute for them. The dude won 23 states in the Democratic primary and had the most support among people under 30 of anyone running, so to me, it was a great fit. People would ask me in surprise, "Are you some kind of socialist?" And I would answer, "I just love the idea of everybody having opportunity." I got the "be careful who you associate with" line, but I was associating less with the man than with the idea. For example, that the government, instead of spending my tax money on prisons, should invest in communities that have been starved for too long. All the stuff Bernie was talking about was so real to me because those are the issues, the real issues that human beings are dealing with and talking about at home. He wasn't talking about building a wall or saying America has always been great. He was putting forward big ideas about wiping out student debt and giving young people the opportunity to grow. He reminded me of my mom asking big questions like, "Why shouldn't there be free higher education? It costs hundreds of thousands of dollars if you want to be a doctor. How many people want to be doctors but can't?" That's the kind of questioning I think is so vital to our future. But because I agreed with a lot of the stuff Bernie was saying, people were mad at me. I didn't care. I'm free to like what he was about. How he approached the world, his ideals, and the fact that he was even raising these questions. A lot of people said his ideas were too far-fetched and could never happen. But shit, Donald Trump happened. I don't want to hear about anything being far-fetched ever again. Bernie Sanders actually called my parents' house in Houston looking to connect, and my dad forgot to tell me. My phone number is not listed, but Bernie's people saw me on television wearing his hat and knew I was from Houston, so they tracked down my dad's number and called to see if I could go to a rally in Texas. I was so mad at my dad. Weeks later, he said, "Oh, by the way, I forgot to tell you. Bernie Sanders called." I was like, "Dad, Bernie Sanders called the house and wanted to talk to me? I would have flown to Texas for that." I cooled off, but man, for a second, I was mad at my dad like I was a salty teenager. But as much as I was into Bernie, I also believe that just electing someone and expecting them to make real change happen for us is a dead end. I believe in intersectionality because Bernie Sanders or anyone else isn't going to end racism or bring resources into underserved communities. We are going to need to connect with each other to bring about these shifts. I hope we have more political candidates who express the values Bernie was talking about. But we still have to do the work. My parents raised me to challenge the system and to question facts when they are presented to me. You have to question the way things are because curiosity is what drives the future. Questions are the starting point for making any kind of change. This is how I approach the world, and this is how we are raising our daughters so their future can be whatever they want it to be. Our daughters and the power of women. My message is to never quit. Never give up. When you have a little trouble here and there, just keep fighting. In the end, it will pay off. Gabby Douglas. When I decided not to stand for the anthem, I did one interview where I said, "I love hot dogs like any other American. I love football like any other American. But I don't love segregation, I don't love riots, I don't love oppression. I don't love gender slander." That statement made a lot of people do a double take. Not the part about loving hot dogs. I do love hot dogs as long as they're all beef and aren't the kind with the rat feces. That's nasty. It was the part about gender slander. That is very important to me. And I make sure that supporting women's rights and speaking out against sexism are central to everything I do. Some of that comes from the strong women I've always had in my life. My mother, my grandmothers, my aunties, and on down the line. Strong-minded doesn't begin to describe the women in the Bennett family. One of my grandmas, Rebecca, is where I get my attitude. She's a spunky old woman with a bad attitude. But at the same time, she's the most loving person in the world. That's what makes her so special and so crazy. She'll cut you down and then be the first person crying when you leave. But I can say that the push to link any work I do to the struggle for women's rights starts with the woman I met when she was 15 and I was 16, who has become more than a wife, more than a partner, an intertwined spirit. We've now been together more than half our lives, and it's the deepest possible connection I can imagine having with another human being. The greatest gift we've given each other over the years is seeing each other evolve from the kids we were in high school to the people we are today. Think about how much you change from ages 15 to 30. There were no guarantees we would grow in the same way. Teenage relationships tend not to last for that reason. But here we are today, making this journey together, shoulder to shoulder. Pele stands beside me, not behind me. I could never be serious about changing the world if I lacked the belief that my wife can be a community leader, a philanthropist, an activist, and a change maker. I owe her so much because, to be truthful, it is only through her eyes that I have come to see the problems of the world. I would be blind to the people's pain without her. Her empathy is like an electrical current that runs between us and flows from her mind to mine. I am at the point where I would die for what I believe in. And I can say honestly that I would never have come this far without meeting Pele and loving her to the point that I would lay down my life for her. From being a teenage mother, when we had nothing but uncertainty, to the present moment, when she is using the power of her voice and her convictions to affect people, I sometimes look at her and shake my head, amazed by the person she is still becoming. Her love has taught me to love. For both of us, this journey would have been impossible without the ultimate change makers in our own lives, our three daughters, Peyton, Blake, and Ollie. Having daughters has allowed me to be kind, to be unafraid, and to be emotional. They've cured me of thinking about myself first. It's the best thing that has ever happened to me. I've had people try to discredit me as a man by saying, "Well, you don't have a son." I laugh in their faces and say, "Who cares? My daughters will be better than any man I could ever create. They're the future." I look at my family completely differently from people who have an obsession with the gender of a child. I think, I have three young, curious people in my life, and they can be whoever they want to be. If I had a son, he would carry the burden of having everyone in his life ask him if he was going to follow in my shoes and play in the NFL. And I have some big shoes to fill. For every Clay Matthews or Peyton Manning, I can point you to a mess of young people who try to follow their fathers into this game, only to meet with disappointment and dashed dreams. It would be even harder for my son than, say, Mark Ingram, a running back for the Saints whose dad played wide receiver back in the day. That's because a son of mine would have to fight me to get onto the field. I felt like I had to play football. Any son of mine would not. He'd be pressured by friends and coaches to play, and he would hear from his mom and me that the safety of his brain and body was too important for all that. But when it comes to our daughters, we don't have the burden of football on their future, or what other people say their ambitions should be. No one puts them in that box. They can be whoever and whatever they want. They can be astronauts, or create a cartoon series like their uncle tell us about being an astronaut. It's all there for them. I have one daughter who wants to cure malaria, another who wants to be a dentist, and another who wants to be a veterinarian. Some days they say they want to be singers or princesses or soccer players. I love the creativity of their minds and the fact that they truly feel they can be whoever they want to be. Pele and I wrote a children's book about our kids called Three Little Monsters Have a Wild Day. They can wreak havoc when things aren't sitting right, but they are also so cute that it's tough to stay mad. My youngest daughter, she can be a monster for sure. Some days I'm like, yeah, you could have gotten 3 sacks today with that attitude. I know they're going to be something greater than I am because the things I have done are primarily around sports. I'm branching out, but the center of my life at this time has to be football. My daughters really have a chance to change lives. I'm excited about it. Every day I tell my wife, oh, I can't wait. 7 more years and Peyton is going to college and she's going to be this. Whenever I go on trips like to Haiti or Japan or South Dakota, my family goes with me. It's not just about my growth. It's about growing together as a family. Not just living on screens, but staring the reality of the world in the face. Because if they don't see the truth of what's out there, the world will never change. That's something I want for every child. When I look in my children's eyes and they are seeing the possibility of being change makers in this world, it feels like a miracle. When I go to a youth prison and look into the eyes of a child the same age as my oldest daughter, but the light, that spark, is out, it tears me up inside. I do what I can for my daughters, but the truth is that they do something even better for me. I try to see the world through my daughter's eyes, thinking about what they will have to experience on their journeys as black women, and it keeps me up nights. The more I imagine what is headed their way, the more determined I am to see change. At a time when our consciousness about sexual assault is expanding with the hashtag MeToo movement, the particular abuse experienced by black women remains under discussed. We can't change shit unless we talk about it. According to the Department of Justice, 40 to 60% of black women report having been sexually assaulted by age 18. And a shocking 40% of black women are assaulted by their husbands or partners. When you factor in how much sexual violence goes underreported, this is even more disturbing. The brutalization of black women goes back to our arrival in this country in chains. Enslaved African women were beaten and raped as if they weren't even human. That made their hurt and pain seem like something normal, and it continues to this day. This is only a part of what my daughters are going to have to confront. The United States also has one of the highest rates on the planet of women who die during childbirth, a rate that has doubled since 1987. This is a national disgrace, and it is even worse for black women. According to ProPublica, black women are 3 to 4 times more likely than white women to die while giving birth. Even Serena Williams almost died during childbirth. Serena Williams. Researchers say that they can't explain these mortality stats. They cite risk factors such as high blood pressure, obesity, and diabetes, but then they tell the world that the cause of increased maternal death for black women is unknown. That is either ignorance or cowardice in the face of obvious truths. The cause is the weight of racism, sexism, and the stress that black women have had to carry for generations as the heart of families while they earn 63 cents on the dollar. That's the cause. The greatest testament to black girl magic I can think of, other than the daily miracles my girls create, is the way black women have persevered despite centuries spent trying to bring them down. Now that I have daughters, I understand further what women's rights are all about. They have become immediate and urgent to me, when they weren't before. This is just me being honest. Women's issues were someone else's problem, and because I have a dick and balls, I felt like it was not mine. But knowing that sexism and gender violence and employment discrimination are going to be real obstacles in their lives makes me want to fight for girls and women with all my heart. I wish it didn't take having daughters for men to realize that this is their struggle, too. It should be enough that we are all human, and we should want equality. But the reality is we live in a world where women, especially black women, aren't valued. And that often means that until we are looking at the world through our daughter's eyes, we just don't get it like we should. My daughters are the reason I am working with an organization called I Am the Code, the first African-led global movement to mobilize government and private sector investors